Hello and welcome to Outdoors in Scotland. I'm John Burns and this is my podcast for folk who like to be outdoors in Scotland. And it's also not just about outdoors in Scotland. It's also really about people who are interested in nature and mountains in general. So I've talked to quite a lot of very famous mountaineers who've climbed things far, far greater than the little hills I've bumbled up. But today's a first, really, for Outdoors in Scotland, because it's almost like a virtual book launch. Because my guest today is Mick Confrey, and his book is Fallen, George Mallory, the Man, the Myth, and the 1924 Everest Tragedy. It's out today. It's you get it now. It's nice and warm. You know, it's just been cooked. So if I can introduce Mick. Hi, Mick. How are you?
I'm very good, actually. The sun is finally shining.
Yeah, it's shining here. There must have been a slip-up somewhere. I don't quite know what it is. But
I've just been dancing around the maypole.
Was it you that caused it, maybe? I don't know. So your book's out today. It's really exciting. I've actually done a little launch like this before. Obviously, it's about George Mallory, and I did my little play about George. He's a fascinating character, and his adventures and what happened with him on Everest. I mean, if I could ask you to set the picture, because I think back in 1924, the ascent of Everest or the attempt on Everest were actually far more significant than of massive public interest, really, which is different from the way it is today. Is that a fair comment, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, the kind of fundamental thing is in 1924, Everest hadn't been climbed. I mean, Now it has been climbed. Maybe 5,000 people have gotten to the top. I can't quite remember. I think like even this year, there are 300 people trying to get to the top of Everest and probably about another 500 Sherpas assisting them. 1924, nobody had been there. Right. Access to Everest was very strictly limited. It took years of diplomatic pressure from the British mountaineering community and their contacts in the kind of diplomatic service to get permission just to make an attempt. So in 1924, they had made one attempt already. There was a reconnaissance expedition in 1921. There was a proper attempt in 1922. And they'd done really well. They'd got to about 27,000 feet, 27,300 feet, but they were still 2,000 feet short of the summit. And so 1924 was very much billed as, let's finish the job. You know, we've had a go, we've done pretty well. Now we're going to finish the job. And who's going to finish the job for us? Mm-hmm. George Mallory is. That's why he was such a key figure. He was seen as the talismanic figure for the British expedition.
Yeah, I mean, George Mallory and Sandy Irving vanished on their fateful attempt, which is almost exact. Well, it's pretty close to 100 years ago. The centenary is rapidly approaching. Tell us about who George Mallory was and why was he so high on the ridge at that point? What got him to Everest?
George Mallory was in 1924, he was working as a lecturer for the adult education department of Cambridge. He had, prior to that, he'd been a teacher. Mallory was a very interesting character who was in lots of ways very kind of socially committed, or he certainly had lots of big ideas. He was interested in politics. He was interested in social issues. But the thing that he was very good at was climbing. The thing he was very good at was climbing. He wanted to be a writer. He had lots of social interests. He was very interested in politics. The thing which kind of made him stand out was that he was a very good climber. In some respects, you know, there was a kind of randomness to why he was chosen. If you like, if you want to go to the Olympics this year, you have to go through a lot of heats, and then they whittle you down, and then they choose the best sport climber, for example. Whereas in 1924, the actual kind of pool of eligible talent was quite small, and it was sort of who was in the know. And Mallory was part of a social circle, yeah. a kind of middle upper class social yes. circle, for whom climbing was a kind of big sport. It was, you know, something they a lot of people were very taken by it. And yeah. but Mallory stood out as being having, you know, very good technique and also being rather fearless. He was highly regarded within the mountaineering community. Certainly his fellow mountaineers would have seen him as being, you know, one of the best in Britain at the time. But, you know, you have to just remember that that the actual pool of people, for example, who'd been to the Himalayas was tiny. I mean, you know, 1924, probably the number of people in the whole world, excluding the indigenous people who lived there, but if you're thinking about mountaineers, inverted commas, sportsmen, was probably fewer than 100 yeah. that actually even yeah. just set foot in the Himalayas. Yeah. You know, this is really...
It was very much the time of the sort of gentleman climber, wasn't it? It wasn't a working class sport, because it was restricted to people who could, one, afford it and had the time to actually dedicate to it.
Precisely, you know, it was a leisure activity, if you like. Mountaineering began in the 19th century as a kind yes. of extension of the people who would go on what they call the Grand Tour of Europe, and then gradually going to the Alps became part of that. Going up Mont Blanc became part of that.
Yeah,
and then the sport of mountaineering was sort of begun in the mid-19th century, but you know it was pretty much focused on Europe, and so you had to have enough money to be able to get there. But that being said, you know, one of the things that Mallory was, you know, very much part of was there was a group called the Climbers Club, and they advocated climbing in Britain, and so they were climbing in Snowdonia, they were climbing in the Lake District, but still in general it was people who had the time and the money to be able to do it, and so yeah. that yeah. necessarily was exclusive. It wasn't really until the 20s and 30s that you started getting a kind of a more wider social mix. And then certainly in the 1950s, by the time Joe Brown and people like that yes. come up, then it becomes a much more egalitarian sport.
That's right. So if we go back to 1924, I mean, you know, in some ways, the conquest of Everest was kind of like the third pole. There was a national interest in it, focused on, I suppose, Great Britain making this achievement. And obviously, we're only a handful of years after the end of the First World War, which had kind of traumatized the nation, or traumatized the world, I guess. But at that point, then we've got, I think, is it the 8th of June? We've got George Mallory, who's the expert climber, and Sandy, the younger Sandy Irvine, who's not that much of an experienced climber, but certainly a very strong, fit individual, and they're high on Everest, trying to make for the summit. And Noel Odell, I think, is the last person to see them heading up. What do you think? One of the things that I think perhaps I wonder about George Mallory is if he was someone, he did make the ultimate sacrifice. But I wonder if, you know, obviously the great mystery is whether Mallory and Irvine actually reached the summit. Obviously, I'll ask you about that. But one of my feelings about George Mallory is that if he got into a position where he could make the summit, but he knew he couldn't get down, I think he probably would have continued. Does that make any sense to you at all?
Well, you see, that comes down to, in a sense, several things that you've said are kind of why I've written this book, because
right.
I think that there are my opinion, or the way I come at these things is perhaps slightly different, you know, because I think that, you know, I think small things, I don't think that the conquest of Everest has got much to do with the North and South Pole or the First World War, you know. Right. I think the British climbers were trying to get to Everest from the 1890s. They made a very big effort in 1903. They made another big effort in 1913, you know, before the First World War. Yeah. So I think the First World War was really important to Everest, but it wasn't because of it traumatizing any climbers or needing a moment of national salvation. It was because Russia was taken out of the geopolitical picture. Prior to this First World War, the great fear amongst British diplomats, particularly the people who are in India, was that Russia would invade India.
And
the Himalayas. And so all of the diplomats were very nervous about anybody getting into Tibet because they were feared it would provoke the Russians. They thought that there was this thing now called the Great Game, which was basically people, explorers, kind of going around the Himalayas and that kind of area. But that was the buffer between Russia to the north and India to the south. And after the First World War, when Russia was defeated and the Tsar was killed and a new revolutionary government took over, the fear that Russia would invade India disappeared. So at this point, the politics changes, and that's why British climbers were able to get into Everest in 1920, but weren't able to get 1921. Sorry, they got permission in 1921, but couldn't get permission in 1903. It was because of the geopolitics. And then secondly, this idea of the North and South Pole. Well, you know, this language calling Everest the Third Pole really come in until the 1930s. You know, I've read lots and lots of newspaper cuttings and lots of speeches from people. And that thing about comparing Everest to the North Pole and the South Pole, I found very, very few references, if any, to that. I think it was a mountaineering challenge. I think that once all of the mountains in the Alps had been climbed, people started looking around the world for higher mountains. And once Everest had been identified as the highest mountain in the world, they wanted to climb. And suddenly there was a kind of general sense that, you know, the British invented mountaineering in the 1950s, made it into a sort of more formal sport where it had a journal and a club.
Yeah.
And that it was by right the British should get to the summit of Everest. And it also happened to be rather handy because India was part of the British Empire.
Oh, right.
You go through India to get to Tibet and Nepal. And so it was very hard. If you were a German climber, an American or a French one, you wouldn't get a chance to have a crack at Everest. Because those countries had no diplomatic leverage. But Britain had diplomatic leverage with Tibet. Because it was supplying it with machine guns, you know.
Yeah,
so the reason why does the Dalai Lama say yes in 1920 is partly because Tibet is fighting China and seeking British assistance, you know. But the biggest thing that I think is that, you know, so much of the kind of the question about Mallory and Irvin, but Mallory in particular, you know, did he get to the top, you know, and can he work out whether he got to top? I would kind of look at it in a slightly different way. I would say, did Mallory turn back before he got to the top? And that if you look back at 1924, there were basically two camps when it came to this question, did Mallory get to the summit or not? And there was one camp, which was Edward Norton, who was the leader of the 1924 expedition. Or he took over as leader when the initial leader got ill. And Norton didn't think that Mallory got to the summit, and he did think that he would have turned back, because Norton's argument was that Mallory was very aware of Irvin's youth and inexperience, and that he wouldn't have taken an undue risk with Irvin. And he argued this position, and most of the climbers on the team agreed with Norton that Mallory wouldn't have put Irvin in a position where he was unduly risky. It was one thing for him to risk his own life, but to risk somebody else's life. Then there was another position, which was Mallory's great friend, somebody called Geoffrey Winthrop Young, who was a very famous climber who'd had his leg blown off in the First World War and would have undoubtedly been on Everest if it hadn't been for that injury. And he had climbed a lot with Mallory, and he said, listen, you know, if Mallory had got a sniff of the summit, and, you know, undoubtedly he got very high on Everest, that he would have gone all the way. And he famously said, because Mallory was Mallory, you know. His experience of Mallory was that he was somebody who couldn't really turn back.
Right.
And, And so Winthrop Young said, no, I think that Mallory got to the top and he probably died. And Mallory's supporters who put forward this argument, kind of, although they didn't say it explicitly, their vision was that he made this last, his first biographer, David Pye, he made this last desperate bid to get to the top, probably got to the top, and then died on the top. You know, this was the kind of idea that Mallory got to the summit and probably died on the top. So, as I say, you've got one camp, which is Norton, which says, no, he went pretty high, realised that it was too dangerous for both himself and particularly for Irvine, and turned back. Or you've got this other camp, which says, no, he would have gone all the way. And what I think is that the evidence that we have now, which principally is that his body has been found.
Yes, his body was found.
Leads you to believe the thesis that he turned back. Because if according to Geoffrey Winthrop Young and all of these people from that period, he made this desperate attempt for the summit and then gave out at the top. And that sort of makes sense. You know, you could imagine that, you know.
Yeah.
But the idea that he and Irvine could have got all the way to the summit and then almost got back to their top camp. And we know that because we know where his body has been found. The body is at, you know, something I can't remember, is 27,000 foot, somewhere around that.
Yeah, yeah.
So he would have had to get all the way to the summit and all the way back with this very inexperienced climber, Irvine, with him. And so to me, that is a kind of, you know, I'm not into all of this kind of, you know, trying to analyze all the clues. I find that rather
cool. Oh, I know. The people write about the fact that he didn't have his photograph of Ruth in his.
Yeah, book. Yeah. All of that. I just think, you know, I just think it's the big thing, you know, the big picture to me is, where was his body found? All right. What does that tell you? It's found actually relatively low down. So that to me indicates more that he would have made a sensible decision, got high on the mountain, got to this particular feature, the second step, thought, no, that is too difficult for us. Let's turn back. And then on the way back, they slipped and died.
Yeah.
And you know, that is what Norton, Edward Norton, believed in 1924.
Right.
And I would say, you know, you can't, this is obviously why this story is fascinating, is because you can't prove it either way. It is possible that he did go all the way to the top, and did almost get back safely. You know, nobody can rule that out. No, but you have to kind of have a sense of what is likely and what's unlikely. And I go with the people who think, look, you know, he would have looked at the second step, thought, look, this is just really difficult. And then he would have, you know, part of him must have realized that Irvine was inexperienced. And by the time June the 8th, you know, Irvine is not in great shape. You know, he's kind of, he's got terrible sunburn. He's got this terrible hacking cough. Mallory, too, is nursing various injuries. You know, undoubtedly, we know for certain that they got very high because there was an oxygen bottle found very high. So that they, you know, they got higher than anybody else. But I go for the, I think the argument should be, did Mallory turn back? Did he have a moment of epiphany where he kind of said, no, in normal circumstances, I would probably take the risk. But today, I'm not going to take the risk with my life or Andrew Irvine's life. And he turned back. And so that's sort of my conclusion. But anyway, so I think that, and that's what, you know, if you said, you know, obviously the thing about Mallory is like dozens of books have been written about him, you know.
Favorite
Everest climber, and everybody's got an opinion. But I think that we should refocus it that final day, not simply did he get to the top or not. It was, did he make a decision to turn back or not, which is equally relevant.
Yeah.
And as I say, I think there's lots of things have crept into the way we talk about that 1924 expedition. For example, the association with the First World War, you know, which has just become a given, but I don't buy into it at all. I mean, if you look at the first British mountaineer to die in the Himalayas, was Albert Mummery, and he died in climbing on a mountain called Nanga Parbat in the 1890s, I think. You know, so British climbers were pushing the edge long before the First World War. You know, Edward Whymper tried to get to Everest in the late 19th century and you know, went to South America, climbed in South America. You know, people wanted to climb bigger and bigger challenges. And the idea that you know, and if they were traumatized by the First World War, you know, it obviously had different effects on different people, because Norton and Somerville turned back. They got to 28,000 feet and they turned back. I mean, that's higher than anybody had been ever before, but still something kicked in, which said, you know, we're willing to, there's a great quote from Somerville. He said, you know, we're willing to risk our lives. We weren't willing to throw them away. That, you know, the vast majority of climbers had a strong sense of, you know, where to draw the line, but Mallory didn't. But that had nothing to do with the First World War. Mm-hmm. Mallory was a risk taker from childhood. You know, there are all these stories from his childhood where he goes out, it sits on a rock in the middle of the sea in order to see how high the tide is going to be. You know, his friend said, you know, he was a risk taker. He couldn't get behind a car without overtaking.
I heard that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, but equally, his friend said at this point in his life, in his late 30s, he had started to change. He had mellowed. And so the newer, mellower, more sensible Mallory would have had a greater sense of other people's lives who he was responsible for, and therefore wouldn't have gone all out for the summit if he thought he wouldn't get down.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that Mallory has become, I mean, it's in some ways his courage and the fact they lost their lives, and in some way that kind of seems to me to symbolize something about man and about mountaineering, and they've both in a way become iconic figures. Isn't that's the case?
Well, I mean, you know, I think that there is no question that Mallory is a very determined individual, and you know, that he is, if you know, the quality of not giving up is a great quality, isn't it? And the whole quality of who dares wins is a kind of great quality, but it has to be tempered with a bit of intelligence and a bit of restraint, you know. And so I think that, you know, that what's great about Mallory is that he's so full of energy. He's kind of so up for it. And he's not constrained by his fears. But I also think, as I say, that you know, we should understand him, or I have huge admiration for Edward Norton, who got to 28,200 feet without oxygen in 1924, higher than K2, higher than higher than Kanchenjunga. But he is forgotten. You know, we don't because we know that he didn't get to the top, but because of the possibility that Mallory got to the top, that we're kind of interested in. But also, I think the thing about Mallory was that he has this other side to him. He was a very charismatic guy. He wrote about climbing. He wrote about the outdoors in a way that was different from other people, you know, that he had a famous essay, The Mountaineer as Artist, you know.
Yes,
He's saying that the mountaineering isn't just about getting to the top or winning or the gymnastics to it. There's a kind of spiritual dimension to it. It touches you in a richer way. Mm-hmm. And that's what his kind of, you know, that's part of his kind of greatness, that he elevated mountaineering into something really special, you know. And, you know, so he, and then he's so interesting because, but also, you know, in a way that we all love James Dean and Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin you know, and Mallory's great hero was Shelley, the poet who died in 1920, age 29. And the people who don't go old, you know, who sort of who die young, that we have a life cut short and stuff. But also they didn't decline in the way that the rest of us mortals do, you know.
Well, that's right. I mean, there can never be another Mallory and Irvine. They will forever be remembered for that attempt on Everest and facing a struggle against a mountain that in many ways is far greater than the kind of struggles that we face against it today.
Undoubtedly, yeah. I mean, it's sort of, look, listen, There's no question that Everest is an incredibly dangerous place, and it's you just look at the numbers of people getting killed in the last 5 years. You know that you have an ever-present risk of avalanche. You know you have to go through this kind of feature at the bottom, the Khumbu ice fall on the Nepalese side. You have to climb up the various steps on the ridges on the north side. You know, it is what they say objectively very, it's a dangerous place to be. And no matter how many Sherpas there are and how many fixed ropes there are and how many bottles of oxygen, it is still a dangerous environment. But obviously in 1924, it was you got to add to that to the fact that their oxygen sets basically didn't work.
Yeah.
You know, that they're going into a route which nobody has ever done before, so they don't know where to go. The kind of ropes that they had were kind of nothing like the quality of modern ropes. The clothing they had was very good, but was not very good when you were hit by terrible weather. They didn't have any communications to speak of. So objectively, it's much, much harder than it is today. Yes, but nobody should forget that, you know, it's easy to be cynical and say, oh, look at those people in that big queue. It's so easy for them now.
Easy is a very relative term, isn't it, really?
Exactly.
True. Listen, it sounds a fascinating book, and I think there's so much more to be said about Mallory, and so much more to be talked of. But it certainly sounds like, I mean, obviously, you've written several books about the Himalayas, and I think your expertise in that must be almost second to none, really. So I'm very pleased to be here at the launch of your new book, and I hope it does very well. I'm sure it will. Thanks very much for talking to me, Rick.
All right, thank you. That's great.